Chapter 32, A Taste of Israel. I have never dwelled on the negative, as far back as I can remember. Life to me has been about possibilities for achievement rather than opportunities for failure. I wanted to learn, to accomplish, to be respected. Perhaps my positive attitude, even at an early age, was a defense mechanism for the hurt of my mother's difficulty. Or maybe it is simply in my genes, as inherent as my light green eyes are. I have never wasted much time on trying to psychoanalyze myself. Why I am the way I am is less important than whether my ideas are sound and my conduct honorable. Many times in my life I have not lived up to my own standards, and when I fail, I am tougher on myself than my critics could ever be. At 21, I possessed a dangerous combination of naivety and positive attitude. Although I could completely and competently discuss many subjects and many aspects of science, religion, philosophy, and politics, it seemed I was often oblivious to real dangers. To me, life was as elemental as a historical novel. Life did not seem to demand a lot of distracting detail, just a strong enough commitment. I sincerely believed that somehow right and justice would ultimately triumph in the world, as if there is an intrinsic power in justice, independent of the physical world. My father told me repeatedly that everything works out for the best, offering examples from his own life and career. Probably the biggest fault of idealists and the chronically positive is that they are seldom inclined to look at what can go wrong. Instead, they focus on what they want to go right. That attitude is fine for a golf swing, but it's poor for a chess game or in a war. My full speed ahead mentality almost cost me my life in 1971. While I was in Laos, I carefully planned my trip home. I was hungry to see Burma, India, Pakistan, Israel, Istanbul, Greece, Rome, Munich, and London. In Europe, I had planned meetings with right-wing leaders in Greece and Rome, in Germany and England. I had one suitcase crammed with books and literature on the racial and Jewish issues for my contacts in Europe. I also had dozens of copies of newspapers and leaflets that I'd written on race and Jewish supremacism. And to complete my potpourri of racist items, I had dozens of brass swastikas I had purchased in India. India's most common symbol is a swastika. It can be found on autos, ships, government buildings, bicycles, and almost anything else imaginable. One can buy this ancient symbol of the Indo-European race in shops and from curio stands all over the country. For a few pennies apiece, I picked up a handful of beautifully carved and engraved brass swastikas, thinking that they would make appropriate gifts for the European racialists with whom I had appointments. On a long flight from Pakistan to Israel, it began to dawn on me that I was deeply into a very stupid mistake. I was headed to the nation of Israel, flying to the most security-conscious airport in the world at Tel Aviv, and my bags were full of swastikas and anti-Semitic, in quotes, literature. For years, I had been aware of the suppression, torture, and terror going on in Israel against Palestinians and their sympathizers. American tourists that made the mistake of simply having Palestinian friends or associates back home have been arrested as spies for simply taking tourist photos while in Israel. I knew how the Israelis treated their enemies, and how they routinely used torture on their political prisoners. I knew, too, that the Anti-Defamation League kept extensive files on anti-Zionist activists in the United States, and that they shared the information with the Mossad, Israeli intelligence. I also knew that anti-Semitism was a serious crime in Israel. I put myself in serious peril. I realized the gravity of the situation only during the in-flight meal on the trip from Pakistan. I spent the rest of the night in nervous agony. I could not finish my food, and I could not even sleep. I found it impossible to read my travel book. My life flashed before me like an old Edison newsreel, interspersed with contemporary, full-color news accounts of my impending tragic fate in Israel. The longer I went without sleep, the more intricately my imagination painted a gruesome picture of my demise. Articles I had read from the British press, particularly the Daily Telegraph, about the Mossad's torture of thousands of Palestinians, came flooding back to me. Daydreaming, I could see beady-eyed agents attach the electrodes to my fingers and toes. In my imagination, I could feel the warmth of an overhead aluminum hooded light as it cast dark shadows on their faces, making their eyes darker and more sinister. I saw visions of my lifeless body being dumped on the side of a dusty desert road, and I pictured my father reading a Mossad-authored telegram that stated regretfully that his son had been a victim of Arab terrorists and that arrangements would be made to send the body home. A lady cloth importer who was traveling from Pakistan told me that since the recent Lod airport bombing that all incoming passengers and their luggage were thoroughly searched. After hearing that bit of bad news, I wrote a short but melodramatic letter to Chloe and one to my mother and father telling them of my love for them and the white cause. I cursed my stupidity and explained what might happen to me. I wrote that I would call them as soon as I landed in Israel so that if they did not hear from me by phone, I was probably in Israeli custody or dead. I wrote a fake name and the return address of a friend on the envelope and gave the letters intended for my parents and Chloe to an American passenger who was from a small town in Georgia. He was connecting to a flight in New York City and then home. Thinking these words might be my last, I conjured up all the poeticism that I could muster. Quote, I can see the last orange streaks of the sun give way to the darkness of the desert kingdoms below, and I know that when this plane descends, my own sun may burn out as well. If you read this letter after hearing from me by phone, you'll smile at my anxious moments shared with you by these words. But if you read these words without hearing my voice beforehand, then you'll be anxious about me, for you will be fearful for me because of my own stupidity. I went on to say, contact the U.S. State Department immediately if the Israeli government is holding me. They need to know that you know that they have me, so I won't meet with any untimely accidents blamed on Palestinian terrorists. I went on, I know that my racial activism has caused you a lot of worry and frustration over the past few years, but I do believe that if you were confronted with the information I have acquired, you would have acted similarly. Maybe there is a fine line between the foolish and the heroic. I am sure that I'm far more on the foolish side of that line. Yet, I am just as convinced that the ideas to which I'm dedicated are honorable, correct, and important. The facts and ideas vital to the survival of our heritage must be the most important information in the whole world, because they determine the fate of millions and truly the sum of human evolution. If you don't hear from me again, send all my love to all and tell them if they want to remember me, they can do that best by fighting for the survival of our heritage. The last line I desire to write in this letter is the expression of my deep and abiding love for you both. Those were some excerpts from the letter I wrote to my parents on that, it seemed, ill-fated flight to Israel. Finally, at dawn, I forced myself to eat breakfast, thinking it could be my last decent meal, and maybe my last meal ever. It struck me as funny that an airline meal might be my last, and I laughed out loud, earning strange looks from the passengers around me. We disembarked and walked down the stairs into the terminal, escorted by Uzi-toting police in brown khaki uniforms. They were sharp and well-disciplined, and they made sure no passengers wandered off the tarmac and away from passport control. As I stood waiting for my bags to emerge from the rubber-curtained baggage doors, I overheard a couple of the passengers comment the security was tight because of the massacre the year before. I waited a while to claim my bags, wondering if I could slip through customs with my smaller clothes bags and maybe get away before they discovered my seditious suitcase. But I saw that the security forces were matching up the passengers with their baggage. Then my eternally positive nature kicked in, and I hoped against hope that the inspectors would not notice the titles of my books or the nature of the brass trinkets. But as I moved through the double doors into a large room, what I saw chilled me. A shiver passed through my chest as I saw suitcases lined up, opened wide on long wooden tables. Israeli customs were going through baggage items piece by piece, examining everything, including the luggage itself, and then hastily repacked the bags. Sometimes, when the agents could not force all the items back into tightly packed suitcases, they simply put the excess items in plastic bags that they handed to the bewildered arrivals. A number of passengers had already lined up at curtained areas, where, one at a time, they would disappear behind it so as to completely disrobe. I closed my eyes and I said a silent prayer. Finally, I resolved that if my life were to end now, I would face it in a fashion worthy of my forefathers. A strange calm came over me. I was ready to face whatever God had in store. Instead of racing, my heartbeat seemed to be slower and stronger as I pulled my head back in an erect fashion and looked directly into the eyes of the Israeli agent. I slowly placed my passport on the desk. The agent opened it, glanced quickly at my photo, and without a word, motioned me through the checkpoint. I picked up my bags and rushed so quickly out into the main terminal that my breathing came hard. It was then that my heart beat quickly and my fingers trembled. Barely able to suppress shouts of relief, with about 80 pounds of bags, I practically danced my way across the floor, looking for a door out to blue sky and freedom. I asked myself what had happened. It dawned on me that because I had worked for the U.S. State Department in Laos in the American Language School, I had a red government employee passport rather than the standard green. I had been treated as a diplomat. I had not realized until then that my passport would exempt me from customs. I thank God for saving me from my own stupidity in the land of Israel. I had arrived in Tel Aviv on the Jewish New Year, and parts of the airport were closed. I must have looked like an easy mark for a short, moon-faced cab driver who solicited a ride in his taxi. My student finances permitted only a bus ride, so I inquired where the bus stop was. The cabbie protested that there was no bus service because of the Jewish holiday. When I declined him, he pressured me. "I told you, there's no bus service to downtown. Don't you trust me? You think I lied to you? Come," he insisted. "I will take you. Only $20. Instead of simply telling the cabbie that he was right, that I didn't trust him, I made a lame excuse about calling a friend to pick me up. A couple of exit doors and 100 feet more down the corridor was a door marked transportation in both Hebrew and English. At the curb sat a practically new Mercedes-Benz bus with a sign in the front window reading Tel Aviv. It cost me $2 to get to my destination. From the time of that first bus ride into Tel Aviv until the time I left Israel, I noticed little heavy industry in the country. I saw numerous little Jewish shops, but in most of them, the great percentage of goods had labels indicating foreign origin, except for numerous Palestinian handicrafts. I had read extensively about the kibbutz system of collectivized farming. American media are full of stories about how the system has made the desert bloom. But the stories seem to have little to do with reality. Israel does have a large citrus industry, but the media image of the kibbutzim is far from the truth. I usually avoid tourist bus tours, but this time I took one to a few of the kibbutzim. In the main building of one, the first thing I noticed was a large poster-sized picture of Karl Marx. Another room had a portrait of Leon Trotsky. The tour included the kitchen area where I dallied. I opened the food locker and found it loaded with American food products, including a shelf full of Campbell's chicken noodle soup. We toured the living quarters, which were as lavish as a fancy American apartment. On a Tuesday, 10 o'clock in the morning, adults filled the community center. In the fields, we were introduced to a Jewish foreman supervising about 24 workers. They were all Palestinians. I rose before dawn one morning and went to the beach in Tel Aviv. It surprised me to see so many Jews of every physical type on the beach, exercising and running along the surf. Health and fitness is an ethic that Israel teaches its citizens. That morning, I had a long conversation with a Jewish woman doctor who was visiting from Atlanta. She had had a very liberal upbringing and opposed the Israeli policies against the Palestinians. She spoke at length about the rigidly segregated nature of the country. Jews have exclusively Jewish state-financed schools, neighborhoods, and settlements. She reiterated what I already knew, but it interested me to hear it from a Jew. The government does not recognize marriage between Jews and Gentiles. Immigration is permitted for Jews living anywhere in the world, Jews by birth, not necessarily by religion, as many Jewish citizens, in fact, are atheists. While hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were born there in Palestine are not allowed to return to the place of their birth, citizenship and its rights are seldom accorded to Palestinians, and they can be jailed and held indefinitely without charge. The government of Israel is theocratic. It instills a strong religious, ethnic, national patriotism in every aspect of Israeli life. There is a much-stressed ties to the soil land movement. Militarism and social order are represented by universal military service. An interesting mix of capitalism and socialism, combined with an intense nationalism, guides the country. Concentration camps and jails house many of the Palestinians, and there is a myriad of laws that sustain Jewish supremacy in every walk of life, including the media, which has strict laws that maintain Jewish ownership. Israel has many such Nuremberg-type laws, but the American media, which are dominated by Zionists, would be horrified at the comparison. Before visiting Israel, I believed that Nazism had perished in 1945, but during my 1971 visit, I saw that it was alive and well in the streets of Tel Aviv, in the schoolrooms of Haifa, in the kibbutzim of the highlands, in the militarism, and in immigration policies. As days passed, I began to reassess and refine my comparison of Israel with Nazi Germany. It almost seems the whole mythos of the nation is a huge stage play, built with money from America, Germany, and truly from all over the globe. Israel is not an organic state, as was National Socialism, but an artificial one with little productivity, and a great portion of its national budget coming from outside its borders. Other nations provide its economic prosperity and its military defense. There is no nation like it in the world. Even Israel's forms of racism seem to be a corruption of the racial idealist philosophers of Europe, for Israel's racism is essentially of an exploitive nature. Exactly what the American media accuse whites of practicing. And it is truly a supremacist rather than a separatist doctrine. While most whites want to separate themselves from non-whites, Zionism and Zionist racism is based on exploiting other races close at hand. While racially aware white people are motivated by love of their heritage, Zionists are psychologically dominated by the wrongs, real and mythical, that have been committed against them. Hatred of their perceived persecutors consumes far more of their attention than love expressed for their own kind and creations. No people on earth have created such an all-consuming cult of their persecution. I attempted to talk to a number of Palestinian merchants in Jerusalem about their situation in Israel, but they were suspicious of my motivations and often were reluctant to say much. It is hard for them to trust anyone with Northern European features because, well, some of the Jews also have that kind of appearance. Their fear of the Mossad and other police and army intelligence groups was ubiquitous. Only a few talked with me about the terrifying aspects of the Zionist regime. During my stay, I met some Palestinians who had been jailed, tortured, and abused. Some of them had lost all their possessions, others lost their homes and property simply because their son or daughter was accused of being anti-Zionist. A young Palestinian college student named Rahid, who had been studying in America but was home visiting his parents, talked with me at length about the Arab-Israeli conflict while we drank coffee, strong and thick as mud. He told me how most of his extended family had been forced out of their homes and lands in 1948. Many of his cousins, aunts, uncles, nieces, and nephews could not even visit the land where their forefathers had lived for 4,000 years, since even before the first ancient Israelites of the Bible arrived. From our table in the outdoor coffee house, we could see the streets being patrolled by soldiers armed with Uzis, and, even worse in Rahid's view, average Israeli citizens carrying submachine guns, while almost all Palestinians were forbidden to even have a pistol. He told me, "We don't call it Israel. It's occupied Palestine." During my stay, I also started conversations with the Jews, and I frankly discussed some of the issues with them, being careful to not argue, only inquire. I tagged along with the typical tourist group near the Dome of the Rock and was surprised to hear the Israeli guide tell a number of Palestinian jokes, equating them with imbeciles and animals and monkeys, and it just went on and on. 24 hours before I was scheduled to leave the country, I returned to my hotel after another journey to Jerusalem, only to have the clerk, with whom I was friendly during my stay, tell me that immigration authorities had come earlier in the day and asked questions about me. The clerk told me that she had admitted them to my room, where they stayed for about 30 minutes. My room looked undisturbed when I got there, but when I opened my largest suitcase, I noticed that the top book was not, as I remembered it, Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West, Volume 1. I knew the top book had been Spengler's because I had been reading it and I placed it on top at the last moment in New Delhi. I was relieved to be leaving Israel the next day, but I began to wonder why, since they obviously found these seditious books, that they had not arrested me. Could they have received the records of the Mossad and the Anti-Defamation League in the United States about my, quote, anti-Semitic background? I slept uneasily that night, and the next morning I had the feeling that things were just not right. I surveyed the streets behind me as I made my way to the beach. They might be following me, I thought. The saying, "If they really are out to get you, you're not paranoid," came to mind and made me smile. I decided to enjoy my walk and not to worry. Within a few hours, I nervously settled into my seat on the flight to Istanbul on El Al, Israel's national airline, and breathed a long sigh of relief as the jet lifted off and began to climb over the Mediterranean. I had a chicken salad sandwich and then napped halfway across the Aegean. I arrived at my hotel room in Istanbul about 11 that night and found the hotel restaurant closed. I got a bottle of sealed, sparkling water from the bar and went upstairs, and I crashed in the lumpy old bed. I planned to see the historic Bosphorus the next morning, and I fought for sleep as I excitedly considered my itinerary. I woke at 5:30 a.m. with a dull headache and quickly showered and shaved. I refused to let the headache deter me from visiting the historic edge of Europe. A few aspirins for my head, some fresh bread with bottled water, and I was off for the Bosphorus Peninsula. I rode about 40 minutes on the bus, feeling increasingly ill. I practically forced the driver to pull over and let me off at an Esso gas station, where I rushed for the restroom and I retched. Pale and drawn, my head feeling as though it would burst, I ignored my student budget and caught the first taxi back to the hotel. I managed to call up the American Embassy and ask if there were any good American hospitals in Istanbul. They told me that Athens had the best facilities. At this point, I knew I was seriously ill, life-threateningly ill. I thought about going to a hospital in Istanbul, but had heard they were wretched. Even though I was doubtful that I could make it to Athens, I decided to try. There was an American there, and with my government work, I knew that they would treat me and take care of me. I gathered up my belongings, hailed a cab, and told the driver to take me to the airport as fast as he could, afraid that if the ticket writers knew I was sick, they would not let me aboard. I washed my face and combed my hair, went to the airline counter, and asked them to change my ticket to the next flight to Athens. By that afternoon, when the plane landed in Athens, fever had me on the edge of delirium. I forced myself to act as though I was not ill when presenting my passport. To this day, I am surprised I made it through customs. Stumbling through the airport exit doors into the warm Athens sunshine, I collapsed into the back seat of a taxi and told the driver to take me to the U.S. Naval Hospital. I woke up a few days later. For a few moments, nothing made any sense. What was I doing here? Was I alive or dead? Then a pretty American nurse came in to take my pulse. The doctor told me that I'd come into the facility semi-conscious with a fever of 105, my body reeling from toxins. He said that I'd been a victim of a rare and often deadly form of food poisoning, and he went on to describe it as, quote, sophisticated. You are lucky, he said, that you came to Athens. The U.S. Naval Hospital had the latest equipment to analyze the toxins and produce anecdotes. The doctor said that in my condition, my chances of survival would have been 1 in 1,000 had I remained in Istanbul. As I recovered, I thought about the fact that the Anti-Defamation League had files on my anti-Zionist activities in the United States and how they are directly linked with the Mossad. My embarkation records may have been matched with my American records a few days after my arrival, eventually leading to the agents visiting my hotel room. On confirming my identity, they might easily have poisoned my food on the aircraft, expecting that I would die days later in some hovel in Istanbul. There would be one less enemy of the Zionist cause, and no possible blame or repercussions for Mother Israel. No proof exists that agents of Zionism attempted to murder me. It is certainly possible that I had merely eaten a tainted chicken salad sandwich on the plane, as airline food can be pretty poor. Considering the events that occurred, my suspicions were natural. Yet, I had survived my naivety. I resolved to be a lot more careful in the future. Lying in my hospital bed, pensive thoughts turned to what lay outside my window. The land of ancient Greece. I decided that upon recovery, I would make the most of my time left in Greece and savor its beauty as thankfully as my first breath upon waking from the fever. The next chapter is chapter 33, Greece, a celebration of life.